Back to Soul Rebel Radio on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. I'm Muriel Maria Siu.
And I'm Lex Stepling. So far, we've looked at the educational options some high school seniors have opted for. We've also looked at the pressures high schoolers face from military recruiters and the way the prison industrial complex targets youth coming from underprivileged communities. Coming up next, we have Miguel Paredes and Laura Cambron, who will be talking to us about what neoliberalism is and how the neoliberal economy impacts youth.
Thanks, Lex. This part of the show is about still another option we have after graduating from high school, the option of jobs. Because we need money or we want it, we opt to looking and applying for a job. But when you think in the bigger scope of things, getting a job is just icing on the cake. Because behind every job, there is a story. Where do these jobs come from? Why do we make this or that amount? Who are the people or corporations controlling jobs we take and the money we make? So in this next part, we're going to be breaking it down. We're going to break down how a big part of our economy works, what motivates it, what makes it so appealing, and why we exist in it. And you know, sometimes these are questions we don't ask ourselves because we focus more on making money than where it comes from.
All right, let's see it.
In the 1980s, the Federal Reserve Board conducted a study where they found that the wealthiest 2% of the people controlled 54% of the wealth, and that only 10% controlled 86% of the money. Neoliberalism can be explained by a simple example. If there were 50 people and $50, one of those people would own 27 of those dollars, and five of the people would own 43 of the dollars. Wow! It gets worse from there because according to the U.S. Census Bureau, between 1992 and 1994, the wealthiest 5% of the people increased their profits by 14%. How did this come to be, you ask? Well, there are certain groups and institutions that exist to control the flow of the money all over the world. The World Bank is exactly what you think it is when you think of a World Bank. The International Monetary Fund, or IMF, serves as their credit company. The World Trade Organization, also called the WTO, was made public in 1995, but the idea of a group that regulates trade and creates the rules about who makes the money around the world is old. These financial institutions in turn force so-called third world countries to accept structural adjustment programs. In the global economy, these policies allow for things like energy, water, healthcare, and social services to be sold by private companies rather than provided by public government offices. The world system of neoliberalism allows the free market to control the economy rather than the governments, and this leaves the workers and the consumers at the mercy of the corporations. Therefore, today, ExxonMobil is worth more than the entire country of Pakistan. General Motors is bigger than Peru, and Ford Daimler is worth more than Nigeria. The first of these new economic laws was called the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA for short, and it is a pact between Canada, Mexico, and the United States. NAFTA was made official on January 1, 1994, and it promotes free trade, less government interference, and low-paying jobs in poor communities for the workers. On the day that it was introduced, the Zapatistas organized a rebellion in Chiapas, Mexico, and it is the first known group demanding autonomy, or freedom, from the neoliberal global structure. The following year, the Mexican peso lost much of its value and the Mexican economy was destroyed. By 1998, we could see the drastic effects that this new economic structure had in less than 25 years of existence. In 1973, a high school graduate earned 42% less than a college graduate, but by 1998, the income gap had increased to 89%. In 1970, Steel and auto workers unions numbered over 3 million employees, but today that number is less than 1 million. Today, 55% of American families have zero or negative net worth. In other words, more than half the people in the U.S. are not even worth $1. The latest agreement promoted by the corporate elite is called the Free Trade Area of the Americas, and it will promote free trade. The FTAA has faced many challenges and protests from workers and activists at home and abroad. Because the governments are not protecting the people from these companies that exploit the workers, the rich are getting richer and the poor are becoming poorer. In Cuba, Chiapas, Mexico, and Venezuela, just to name a few, they are challenging neoliberalism, but there are also rebels testing the system throughout North, Central, and South America, as well as the rest of the world. Neoliberalism, in short, means the socialization of cost and the privatization of profits. In other words, everyone contributes to a system where only a few make the money. Have you ever wondered why only certain people in particular communities work specific jobs? Have you ever thought about why there are very few well-paying jobs with union contracts, healthcare benefits, or retirement plans? Although many of us choose to ignore history and politics, the only way we can understand what is going on is by looking at what happens in our neighborhood, in the city, and all over the world. Over 500 years ago, when the system of capitalism was introduced to the world, people lived a very different existence from the one we see today. The economic system required each country called the state to control the factories, also called the means of production, in the industrialized sectors of society. In the past, the factory or company was usually owned by rich men and who controlled the workers that sold their labor or work for the production of an item. In the 1980s, the New World Order was adopted, and this required a very different way of doing business. Workers have moved away from industrial jobs in factories to the service sector, including retail and fast food chains. In this new super capitalism, often called neoliberalism, the corporations are no longer owned by a few rich men, but by shareholders or investors that together own a company. Instead of a corporation like Ford producing cars at an auto plant, they can own the name and subcontract specific tasks to other companies that can do that work for cheaper. This allows for more profits to the corporation and shareholders, but it depends on fewer benefits for the workers, usually at a lower salary or hourly wage. The fall of the USSR, today known as Russia, and the Berlin Wall that separated East and West Germany are the greatest examples of the evolution of capitalism to the current economic model of neoliberalism. NAFTA, the FTAA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, and the European Union are just a few examples of this new global system. Author Susan George writes, "Contrary to classic or Marxist definitions of capitalism, what counts today is much less the ownership of the means of production than control over business activities. So what does all of this mean to young people? This means that today, your life is not controlled by the church, the king, or the president, but by corporations that control the flow of the money and information. This means that students are unlikely to go to the university, and those that do get the opportunity sometimes cannot find a decent job in their field of study. This also means that young people are forced to take low-paying jobs or minimum-wage work with no benefits and part-time schedules. Instead of factories providing decent jobs with benefits and producing goods in the U.S., they are relocating to Mexico, Central America, and around the world where they can offer lower-paying jobs and make more money, exploit the workers, and abuse natural resources. If you do not study or work, young people are encouraged to join the military to fight an unjust war in a country rich with oil. Women make 70 cents to every dollar that a man makes, yet women perform most of the unpaid domestic work. Young parents have to work more than one low-paying job just to feed their children, pay for the bills, and plan their family's future. This means that parents, then, are not at home to raise their children and prevent them from getting in trouble in the streets. This translates to more crime, more gangs or street organizations, and more drugs that create more violence in our communities, which forces more people into prisons. The police and politicians then have an excuse to create laws and policies against the youth. Meanwhile, the poor people have fewer social services, less assistance is offered, and fewer spaces exist for the community. The last question is this. Now that you know that the government and corporations are working together to make your life more difficult and give you less of an opportunity to succeed if you graduate high school, what are you going to change your community, your country, and this world?
I'm sorry, Miguel. I don't mean to interrupt you, but I have another question. Maybe Laura can answer it.
Sure, go ahead.
I know there is definitely a lot to the world and where it might come from and all of that. But can you break it down for, let's say, someone that gets a job at, like, McDonald's and wants to see how this relates to what Miguel has just said?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. Let's say you just got a job at McDonald's, right? All right. And they assign you to flip burgers. So here's how we break it down. In 1 hour, let's say you flip, like, 21 burgers. And a burger costs, like, what, $1.29? So for just that hour, you flipped $27.09 worth of money. But you've only made $6.75 that hour. And just to reiterate why we're talking about neoliberalism and not just you can get this or that job, is to have a more in-depth understanding of the inner workings of many of our jobs, especially of those that are in the service sector, which according to the U.S. Department of Labor, more than 50% are occupied by working teens. And if going to school isn't for you, or you just want to work to save up for school, you should at least know how to protect yourself. There are laws and regulations that have been set up to protect the workers of these different sectors. Something quick to note is that in California, if you're working 8 hours daily, but then they ask you to work more than your regular 8 hours, you're entitled to overtime pay. That's just one example. But if you want more information about how to inform yourself as workers, write this website down, youngworkers.org. That's youngworkers.org. I'm Laura Cambron for Soul Rebel Radio.
Coming up, we'll be hearing from author, educator, and activist Jonathan Kozol, speaking about race, privilege, and education.
This year I got some birthday cards, a lot of cards from college kids and teachers. The birthday was really awful, was 2 years earlier when I was 60. That's a formidable birthday for anyone, anyway, to be 60 years old. Almost everyone I knew forgot me that year. I got a visit from a priest who's very loyal to me. Except for that, I was by myself. But when I went out to get the mail that day, I found this birthday card right here from a little boy in the South Bronx named Mario, 7-year-old. His face is very round, looks like a light on olive with a smile painted on it. One of the nicest kids I've ever known. It was the only birthday card I got. My editor forgot. My publisher forgot. My mother forgot. But Mario remembered. I'm very grateful for this card. I carry it with me everywhere I go. Whenever I struggle to fight off despair and weariness, I think of Mario, and I thank God for giving wise hearts to small children. I've spent most of my life among kids like Mario. I started back in 1964, 34 years ago, exactly this fall, in the segregated public schools of Boston. And I've spent most of the decade since working with Black and Hispanic children, much of the past 5 years in New York City in the South Bronx. In all, I've made about 200 visits up to the South Bronx to talk with children, mothers, fathers, teachers, and preachers who face challenges I couldn't even dream of 30 years ago. I go up on the train. If you're ever in New York, you can fancy store for 59th Street and Lexington Avenue. The richest population quadrant in the Western world, Upper East Side, Manhattan. The wealthiest people in the world live there. You get off the train 14 minutes later at Brook Avenue in the South Bronx, poorest section of the poorest congressional district in America. Also one of the most unhealthy places physically for a child to live anywhere in our nation. Pediatric AIDS is common in the neighborhood. Corruption among children there is common. Asthma has become endemic in the neighborhood. Never been anywhere in the United States or even in the third world where so many children have a hard time breathing. Constant wheezing of the children in the neighborhood. They start to tell you something that's important to them, something that's got some emotional content to it, and suddenly you hear that wheezing sound, the child reaches into her pocket and pulls out this little pump, that's what they call it, an asthma inhaler, little yellow pump. I don't know why, they all have this yellow pump. There are pink pumps and blue pumps, but they all have yellow pumps. It's called Proventil. And you know, and it's like that reassurance to make sure they have the pump so they can keep breathing. I've never been anywhere where so many kids have trouble breathing, and I'm told that that's happening in inner city neighborhoods all over America. After I'd been there for 3 months, I started wheezing too. I developed chronic asthma. I think it has a lot to do with anxiety and tension, nervous tension. I went back to Boston where I live and went to my doctor, and she said, well, you'll have to have a pump. So I said, could I have a yellow one? So I have the same they do. And often children in the neighborhood don't have their fathers at home because so many of the men from the South Bronx are incarcerated. Rikers Island, which is the prison of New York City, is now the largest prison colony in the entire world. There are 20,000 people out there, virtually all people of color. You almost never see a white person out there. It's almost all Black and Hispanic people. And so many women out there now that there's a nursery because babies are born out there. And in some cases, people both are born and die there. If you've ever been to New York City, if you've ever flown into LaGuardia Airport, you've seen Rikers Island, though you probably didn't know what it was. You sit on the right side of the plane next time you go to New York, and just before the wheels touch down at LaGuardia, you look out the window to your right, and you're looking down on the largest prison colony in the world. There's a wonderful view of Rikers Island from the rooftop of one of the buildings that I visit in the South Bronx. You can't see the Statue of Liberty from the South Bronx, but you can see the prison all too clearly. And of course, on top of everything else, this is a totally segregated neighborhood racially. little school I used to visit there. I still go back and visit when I can. First time I walked in, this is an elementary school. There were 800 children in the school, but one white child in the whole school. 800 children of color, one white kid. He was there by mistake and left very quickly. Ask that child's teacher, how many white kids have you taught over the years? Teachers, I'm glad to say, are very honest with me. They don't talk to me as though I were a reporter or, you know, as though I were from the government or something like that. They talk to me as a friend. And I said to the teacher, how many white children have you taught while you've been here? She said, Jonathan, I've been in this school for 18 years. This is the first white student I've had. So this is virtually absolute apartheid in New York City. You'd find the same thing, of course, in every major city of America. But it always stuns me in New York because New York still has that little tradition, at least liberal reputation. You know, New York is the city that sent all those sometimes die with black people. And now it's absolute segregation. And I talk about it all the time when I'm in New York. Not to black people, obviously, they know. Not to Hispanic people, but to white people. And I still have white friends in New York. Some very rich white people who were my classmates, went to college. If you went to Harvard in the 1950s and, you know, and didn't do something crazy like becoming a teacher, but went to business school or law school, you'd be very, very powerful right now. So some of these old friends of mine are very, very important people in New York. And we get together every so often. They like me still. I don't know why. They're nervous with me. They get nervous, they get anxious when they're with me. They think I want to redistribute their wealth. Which I do, but they still like me enough to, like, they want to get together with me. They think that I'm on some kind of a guilt trip. They think that I'm overburdened with worry about the children that I meet up in the South Bronx. I mean, I know kids whose mothers line up at food pantries day after day in order to keep food on the tables, and the food pantries are always running out of food. I mean, I know real hunger. My friends, they don't feel bad for the children in the Bronx. They feel bad for me. Because I feel bad about the children in the Bronx. So you know what they do in New York? If rich people want to cheer you up, what they do is they take you out for lunch. And they take you out to an expensive restaurant, like the Four Seasons food stamps. And they want to talk about the values of the poor. But I want to talk about the values of the rich. And so I do. And these are very interesting lunches, you know. And I talk about segregation. It's not of interest to most people in America anymore. It's sort of off the political agenda. That's why I bring it up. And I force that issue. And I tell them this city is a bastion of apartheid. And they get very upset and defensive about that. Because these old friends of mine, are liberals. Yes, liberals. Liberals. Now, to be truthful, they're not real liberals. They're like ex-liberals. You know, they're like tired ex-liberals. And there are a lot of them in New York. You know, there's so many of these weary old liberals in New York. The New York Times tried to explain it a couple of years ago. Why are so many of these people who were courageous in their youth now withdraw and opposing all the things they fought for when they were young? And you know, the New York Times has to be polite, so it's not going to come out and say be selfish bastards. The Times has to make it sound sort of elegant. So the Times comes up with this wonderful phrase to explain it. It's the phrase is compassion fatigue. Isn't that a wonderful phrase? Only the New York Times could come up. You know, instead of saying, these sons of bitches, they were once decent people and risked their lives. You know, now, after the Reagan years, they don't care about poor folks anymore. No, it has to find this lovely term, compassion fatigue. One black woman, you know, read that. She said, I still can't figure out what those guys did to get so tired.
Again, that was author and educator Jonathan Kozel.
And that will do it for this edition of Soul Rebel Radio. I'm Lex Stepling.
Thanks to everyone who worked on today's program, including Laura Cambrón, Miguel Paredes, Jorge Merino, Chuy Torres, Teresa Dang, and Manuel López. Special thanks to XL Middleton. Today's program was produced by Aura Abogado and engineered by Stan Mizrahi. I'm Muriel Maria Siu. Thanks for listening and tune for Alternative Radio coming up next.